Good afternoon. I'll call to order this remote meeting of the House Commerce Committee and ask Mr. Brown to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson. Vice Chair Katisa-Witun.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Barr.
Here.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson present.
Representative Daphne.
Daphne present.
Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Haley. Representative Cagle. Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly present.
Representative Liz Lagarde. Representative Lucero.
Yes, sir.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Tice. We know he's present, but I'll call again. Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Haley. Representative Cagle. Representative Liz Lagarde. And Representative Tice.
Tice here.
Thank you. And I think we have Representative Haley in the chat or in the Zoom, but she has not said anything.
Ms. Chairman.
Quorum is present. The first item on our agenda is the approval of our meetings from our last minute.
Mr. Chair, I had trouble getting in on Zoom here. As you know, this part of the building has some difficulty with the internet. Just want to make sure that I'm present, O'Driscoll.
And Mr. Brown gives the thumbs up that he has reflected such in the minutes. Representative Katisa-Witun, have you had a chance to review the minutes from our last meeting?
I have, Mr. Chair. I would move the minutes from March 9th.
Representative Katisa-Witun moves the approval of the minutes from the March 9th, 2021 meeting. Any discussion to the motion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 9th, 2021 are approved. We are today having a meeting that will occur in two parts. We will meet from now until 5 o'clock and consider hopefully four bills. We will then recess for caucuses and return at 6:30 to do the rest of our agenda. The first bill on our agenda today is House File 586. Welcome to the committee, Representative Mary Murphy. I will move House File 586 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Transportation, Finance, and Policy. And Representative Murphy, we have an author's amendment to your bill as well. It's labeled A210024. Should we take care of that now?
I really wish you would because it's a much simplified definition of volunteer driver, and it's everybody agrees that this part of the bill is the bill to pass.
Excellent. So I will move the A210024 amendment, which gets the bill in the shape the author would like us to consider it. Any further discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, the motion prevails, and the A21-0024 amendment is adopted. Representative Murphy, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All of you know some senior citizens can drive just fine, but others can't or don't have a license, or they need help to get around. And the volunteer drivers across the state of Minnesota that are working with a nonprofit agency or the county social services have, there are many different kinds of volunteer driver services, but they're known all across the state and they bring people together. They bring people to the dentist. They bring people to the grocery store. They bring people to town. Or they bring people from one town to another town in some cases. But they're volunteer drivers that do this of their own free will in their own vehicles. and their accident rate is almost zero. So it's a very reliable service if people know about it and if there is a definition. Now, 3 or 4 years ago, there were lots of discussions about House File 586, but they didn't have this amendment that you just put on. And this simplifies it, and it makes it understandable of who is a volunteer driver and how they can assist the community as a whole. And all senior citizens don't have to rely on their kids, or in many cases, people they don't know at all. And so this is was initiated by the Department of Transportation, and John Dukic is here to explain why the Department of Transportation is concerned about volunteer drivers.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Mr. Dukic.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Dukic with the Office of Government Affairs at the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And I'd like to begin by thanking Representative Murphy for authoring this bill and for you, Mr. Chair, for taking the time today to hear it. The bill, as amended, represents a collaborative effort between MnDOT, the Departments of Commerce and Human Services, the trial lawyers, and the Minnesota Public Transit Association to address an issue whereby some volunteer drivers are being perceived by insurance agents as transportation network company drivers or commercial vehicle drivers, which they are not. And this misclassification can lead to an increase in premiums for volunteer drivers, or in some cases, the decision by volunteers to simply forego the experience because of a concern about a change in their insurance coverage. And as Representative Murphy mentioned, volunteer drivers use their personal vehicle and are reimbursed for mileage to help people get around town, to bring them to doctors, visits, or cancer treatments, to the grocery store, and run other errands that they might not otherwise be able to do. And this bill, as amended, simply, we hope, helps to clarify what a volunteer driver is and what a volunteer driver is not. And specifically, the bill defines a volunteer driver as an individual who transports persons or goods on behalf of a nonprofit entity or governmental unit in a private passenger vehicle and receives no compensation for services provided other than for the reimbursement of actual expenses. And this helps, we think, to clarify what they are, and it stipulates as well that they are not a commercial vehicle driver. And so, the bill looks quite long, and that's simply because it updates various statutes where the term volunteer driver is used, transportation statutes where this term comes up, and it simply refers back to the definition provided here to make clear what a volunteer driver is and what they are not. And we hope that this bill provides some clarity to volunteer drivers across the state and helps ensure that they continue to provide crucial services for those who need it most. And with that, Mr. Chair, that concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Dukic. There are no additional testifiers who signed up, so now would be a time for member discussion and question. Any discussion to the bill? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that this is a great accommodation, and I've been watching this and have been close to this issue for the last few years, and I invite members to vote yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Any further discussion to the bill? Hearing none, I will turn it over to Representative Murphy for a closing comment.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And I believe this bill, as amended, should go to the floor. Is that right?
I think we're headed to Transportation, Finance, and Policy next.
Okay.
Chair Murphy.
Okay, I'll grease the skids there.
Sounds good. Well, with that, I will just note that you, Representative Murphy, you said that the bill, difference between this bill and the one 3 or 4 years ago was the amendment, but I'll also note it has a different author now, you, and I think that might actually be the difference this time around and why it's moving and being successful. So thank you for bringing the bill, and I will renew the motion that House File 586, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Transportation, Finance, and Policy. Mr. Brown will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Katizowicz.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Dabney.
Dabney, aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
And Representative Tice. Representative Tice.
Tice, aye.
With 16 ayes and zero nays, the motion prevails, and House File 586, as amended, is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Transportation, Finance, and Policy. Thank you again, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The next item on our agenda is House File 970. Welcome to the committee, Representative Vang. I will move House File 970 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. Representative Vang, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here to present House File 970. This is the third committee stop, so some of you may have already heard much of this bill. What this bill does is opens the door to critically and comprehensively address a long-standing problem, a shortage of mental health providers. It is no secret that we have a dire mental health workforce shortage that needs to be addressed, especially in light of the increased needs due to the pandemic. For a long time, poor access to mental health care include rural communities where individuals are less likely to have a mental health treatment facility than metro counties. Communities of color are less likely to get the treatment they need, and low-income communities are less likely to have mental health treatment resources than high-income communities. We are hearing more calls for mental health, yet we don't have the providers to meet the demand. This bill is a product of coalition work among advocates and our institutions over the years. What is relevant to this committee's jurisdiction is Section 1. What Section 1 does is aligns what is already in current practice. The care provided by clinical trainees is already paid for by Medicaid and Minnesota Care, along with some private health plans. So this just also aligns that the care provided by clinical trainees be also paid for by private insurance. And the reason why this is important is because when insurance does not pay for care and treatment, it creates a barrier for a provider to offer supervision for these trainees, and may result in the clinical trainee paying for the supervision needed to be licensed. And with that, I do have testifiers who can explain further about this section and the significance of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Vang. The first testifier I have is Fahua Vang.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you so much for your time today. In order to give every Minnesotan who needs it the very best opportunity for help and recovery, we need high quality mental health and substance use disorder services. And in order to provide high quality treatment, we need competent clinicians. To develop competent clinicians, we need sustainable ways to train and mentor our pipeline of clinical trainees. Clinical trainees, in my testimony today, refer to people who are advanced students in a graduate program in an area of mental health, so social work, psychology, counseling, marriage and family therapy, or more commonly, clinicians who have already graduated with their master's or doctorate and are working under the supervision of another provider. As part of their training, clinical trainees receive practice experiences under the direct supervision of licensed mental health professionals in their field. In order to become a fully licensed mental health professional in one of these fields, clinical trainees must graduate from either a master's or a doctoral program. And then there are some very specific requirements for each of the fields represented here that clinical trainees must meet. But in general, after graduation, part of the requirement is that we continue to work under the supervision of a fully licensed board-approved supervisor in our field for a specified length of time. And then we take a national exam in our field. And if we pass, we then become eligible for full licensure. And once fully licensed, we're able to practice independently. Having been both on the supervisee and supervisor end of the training and licensing path, building a competent workforce takes time and is very much a critical part of strengthening our healthcare system. After the pandemic, it's going to be especially even more crucial that we have a strong system that is able to respond to the mental health needs of Minnesotans across the state. And part of doing that means making the work of clinical trainees a sustainable part of our healthcare system. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next testifier is Sue Abderholden from NAMI. Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and we strongly support this bill. As has been mentioned, we have a severe workforce shortage in Minnesota. And one thing I want to make sure that you understand is that the Department of Health did a study, and between 2007 and 2014, they found that only 49.1% of our graduates from these programs actually became licensed. What we know in the series of discussions that we had around the state is being able to find supervision was a key factor in them not becoming licensed. And I think you could certainly understand that if we're losing half of our people after they graduate not to become licensed, we could really be solving our workforce shortage. I also want to make sure you understand, though, so the barrier that Dr. Yang talked about is real. So if the provider can't actually bill for the service that's being provided by the clinical trainee, it makes it really hard for them to provide the supervision. And often what happens is people have to pay for supervision and not get paid for the work that they do, which I think you can understand would be pretty untenable. I want to make sure that the committee understands that this is not a new mandate. We are not adding any particular types of services. We're just clarifying who can provide the current mandated services. This is already provided for under Medicaid and Minnesota Care. We've not had any problems in terms of, you know, quality or issues. This has been a longstanding policy. And while some private insurance does pay for it, not all. And so, again, we're just trying to address one of the barriers, one of the many barriers that people face in terms of getting their final license. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't have any other testifiers signed up this afternoon, so we will move to member discussion. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson, and thank you, Representative Bang, for bringing this bill forward. I'm not sure if my question is for you or for Ms. Abderholden, but I'm curious, when you talk about the length of time that a trainee needs to be supervised, is that, can you just give me a perspective on that, how many clients that they would need to see, or if it's a specific time frame versus visits that are required?
We also have Sam Sands from the Board of Psychology on the Zoom. I don't know, Representative Vang, if you want that question or if you want Mr. Sands to tackle it.
Mr. Chair, I will defer this question to whoever can elaborate on this.
And I don't know, Mr. Sands or Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Sands can add, but I will just say it's not the number of clients, and it's the number of hours that you're supervised. And I can quick look it up. I know for one group it's 2,000, for another it's 4,000, but it's based on the number of hours of supervision.
Mr. Sands, do you have anything to add to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Haley, thanks for the opportunity to answer this question. What I would say is it differs between the professions. So for the Board of Psychology, we license psychologists, and they do 1,800 hours of psychological practice between when they graduate and when they become licensed. So it would be those 1,800 hours where they would be under this clinical supervision. Some people do more than that. Some people, they have to do that minimum level of of hours. Social work practice, I won't speak for social work or marriage and family therapy or board of behavioral health, but they do have varying hours of supervision time that their licensees or their applicants also have to get supervision before they can become fully licensed.
And Representative Haley, just for your info, we do have representatives from the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy and the Board of Social Work. So if you require additional information, you can turn to them. I do see you shaking your head now. So Representative Haley.
That's fine. I'm trying to respect our committee time this evening. So thank you for that answer. I just wanted some perspective. And I'm somewhat familiar with this issue and just really want to offer support for the bill. Our workforce shortage is severe, and the pandemic and all the ancillary issues related to that will only or have really only increased the mental health crisis from youth all the way to, you know, seniors that have been, you know, in lockdown. So this need is great, and I appreciate you bringing it forward and offer my support. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the bill author, Representative Vang, for bringing this bill forward. I think, all of us have heard in our communities about the mental health workforce shortage, and I appreciate this bill's efforts to improve that in our communities across the state of Minnesota. I know Representative Vang, when we heard this bill earlier in Human Services, I had expressed some concerns around, you know, the insurance coverage and how that would impact, you know, costs of health insurance. And after talking with some of the health plans, you know, they're not, concerned with this language. That they express that a lot of their members already cover this, and so wouldn't impact a lot of their coverage. And so I'm happy to be supporting the bill today and appreciate your work on this important topic.
Thank you. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have one question here, or actually maybe possibly two questions depending on the answer. I would draw the bill author's attention to line 9.19. I see there are two instances of it. Beginning on line 8.32, and this is in the continuing education section of the bill. So lines 8.32 through 9.2, and then again 9.19 through 9.22. And the question I have for the bill author is, when I read these lines, I'm just wondering, for example, line 9.19, why are we focusing on the strengths that exist in various cultures and not the other half of the equation, weaknesses? Line 9.20, why are we only focusing on the differences between cultural groups and not the similarities or commonalities? Line 9.21, why are you focused on teaching the oppression? And how about the other side of that, which would be the empowerment? Because every part of this, there's two sides of every coin. And when I read this, these three examples, it seems to be a focus on just one side, when there's another side, I think, that would give a greater picture to those going through continuing ed. I'm just wondering if the chief author could comment why these particular focus.
And I'll give Representative Vang a chance to speak to that. I would just note that, as Representative Vang alluded to, significant portions of this bill are in affect statutes that are not within the committee's jurisdiction. The portions that you're referencing are housed in Section 148, which is in the Department of Health's section of law relating to the continuing ed requirements there. The bill is being referred from this committee to the Health Finance Committee. So I don't want to go on this, but I'm happy to give Representative Vang a chance to answer your question. I just wanted to note that.
Yeah, totally. And I appreciate, and the reason I'm asking is when I see the words continuing ed, regardless of the statute, as a real estate agent, having to go through continuing ed, as a general contractor, continuing ed. So I'm just asking those questions in that regard. So thank you.
I understand. Representative Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lucero, for your question. You know, this section has been discussed in previous committees and will be continued to discuss and fleshed out in the Health Finance Committee next. However, I can entertain your question in that we recognize that we are a growing demographic here and in a state that is continually changing with a great asset to diversity. We know that the providers that we have currently do not reflect the population of the state. And so this is a process, this is part of where we can continue to be more competent in being outside of our own bubble, and that we can continue to reach a place where we can better serve the communities that now are part of this state as well.
Representative Sarah?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that. But to, for those who might be in a bubble or for those who are trying to expand beyond what they're familiar with, right, it's the totality of information, right? If you're going to look at, you're only concerned about the differences, well, how about the commonalities? Because I think that we, regardless of ethnicity, regardless of race, regardless of religion, I believe we have a lot more in common than we do with differences. So it would be my hope that you would consider in these next committees that you would discuss that you would entertain some language that says something to the effect of allowing for the differences and commonalities between cultural groups. Why are we just focusing on the division part? Focusing on the strengths and the weaknesses of varied cultures, right? Focused on the oppression and the empowerment of social diversity. Let's not just do the negatives. Let's also talk about the positives and what brings us together. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. I see no further member discussion, so I will turn things over to Representative Bang for closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank members for the, in the committee for their support. You know, this is an important bill. It's actually one of the more exciting bills I'm carrying this session, as it's, you know, we recognize that we need to do better for our mental health needs here and for our community, and especially during this time of crisis. And so once again, just thank you all, and I'd be happy to ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Vang. I will renew my motion that House File 970 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. Mr. Brown will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Katiza Watoon.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Representative Dabney.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley. Representative Cagle.
Haley votes aye.
Thank you. Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegard. Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
Tice, aye.
With 17 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails and House File 970 is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. Thank you, Representative Bang. The next bill on the agenda is House File 1576. Welcome to the committee, Representative Bonner. I will move House File 1576 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. Representative Bonner, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill before you is really quite simple. The language is not long or complicated. What is complicated is the way that we pay for and reimburse prescription drugs. We've devised elaborate methods designed to save money, but ultimately they fall significantly short, in some cases costing more across the system than straightforward methods. In theory, reimbursement rates should cover the cost of dispensing the drug, including the cost of the drug itself, the pill bottle, the labels, and the cost of the pharmacist's time and counseling. The reality is that often these rates fall short. While larger chain pharmacies can often smooth out these anomalies over time, it's increasingly harder for your corner drugstore to survive. With clawbacks, shrinking margins, and reimbursement rates that often don't cover costs, these local resources are in danger of being lost. More Americans see their local pharmacist more frequently than their own physician. In small drugstores across the state, pharmacists are a trusted member of the community. Many know their patients by name and their drug history by heart. Often catching errors in prescriptions or incorrect dosages and potential adverse drug reactions or fancy computer software even find it. These resources are indispensable. The bill before you is simple. It asks to remove the prohibition on discussing reimbursement rates, to allow pharmacists to have the conversations about fair compensation to cover their costs. The bill does not change rates or dictate prices. It's simply about transparency and fairness. Transparency that may be the first step on the path to saving these cornerstones of the community and a trusted resource in your pharmacist. And with that, Mr. Chair, I do have Ms. Durr here, to say a few words in support of the bill and, of course, to help with any questions.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Ms. Durr.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Sarah Durr, and I am a pharmacist by training and the executive director of the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. Thank you for allowing me to testify today on behalf of pharmacists, community pharmacies, and independent pharmacy owners. As mentioned, about 95% of patients live within 5 miles of a pharmacy. I am here to testify in support of House File 1576 that would protect our independently owned pharmacies in Minnesota. 2 years ago, the Minnesota legislature enacted a new chapter of insurance law that put in place for the first time licensure and regulation of pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs. The Minnesota Chapter 62W does several things, but central to one of its sections is the legal framework that guides the contractual business relationship between a pharmacy, the payer, and the PBM. The PBM is subcontracted by the health insurer, or HMO, here in Minnesota. Also in 62W, there is a section that removes the prevention on what pharmacists can say or do in relation to the cost information of a medication provided to patients. This is commonly referred to as a gag clause, which meant before 2019 that pharmacists in Minnesota were contractually obligated not to discuss the actual cost of the medication with their patients. 62W prohibits a PBM from enacting a gag clause in contracts with pharmacies. HF 1576 would expand upon 62W by adding provisions that prohibit PBMs from contractually preventing a pharmacist from communicating with or speaking to the health insurer who subcontracts with the PBM. This additional protection for pharmacists and pharmacy owners would allow them to discuss their reimbursement with the health insurer. Many pharmacy owners and pharmacists are forced to sign these take-it-or-leave-it contracts that don't pay the drug acquisition cost and then oftentimes have arbitrary and unexplained retroactive fees. This legislation would allow pharmacists not only to speak with PBMs, but also have the right to speak with their health insurer who has designed the benefit plan. Please support HF 1576, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Durr. I don't see any further testifiers. Representative Haley had your hand up. I see you've taken it down. I don't know if your question was answered or...
I think my question was answered, Mr. Chair, by the testifier.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Haley. Any further discussion or questions to the bill? Seeing none, any closing comments, Representative Bonner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we realize that things like reimbursement rates are complicated and that there's a long road ahead to sort that through. This bill is really just a first step in allowing those conversations to happen and talk about what that looks like so that we can make sure that we find a path that ensures that our local pharmacies, particularly in small towns across greater Minnesota and on your corner in our larger cities, is still available there for you as a resource. Again, these are folks who often know their patients better than anyone else. They see them at the very least once a month. And certainly we want to make sure that these resources are available, that we can have that critical conversation to start talking about reimbursement rates. Thank you to Mr. Chair and the committee.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1576 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. And Mr. Brown will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Katusiewicz.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Minnesota Vaccine.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Representative Daphne.
Daphne, aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
Aye.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
Tice, aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
With 16 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 1576 is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. Thank you, Representative Bonner. The next bill on the agenda is House File 1493, which is my bill, so I will pass the virtual gavel to Representative Katusiewicz.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as Chair Stevenson mentioned, next we have House File 1493. Chair Stevenson, would you like to move your bill?
I will move that House File 1493 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Very good. Chair Stevenson moves that House File 1493 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And it looks like you have an author's amendment labeled A1, Chair Stevenson. Would you like to move that now?
I would move the A1 amendment, which is an amendment to get the bill in the shape I'd like the committee to consider.
Very good. Chair Stevenson moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion to the amendment, members? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? All right, the motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Chair Stevenson, do you have also an author's amendment labeled A3?
I do. Why have one when you can do two? I would move the A3, also an author's amendment. I think this one adds an appropriation.
All right, thank you. Chair Stevenson moves the A3 amendment. Members, any discussion to the A3 amendment? And seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. The motion prevails, and the A3 amendment is adopted. Chair Stevenson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, the student loan crisis in the United States is just mammoth. Total student loan debt has surpassed credit card debt to become the second largest class of debt in the United States, with students owing a stunning $1.7 trillion. Here in Minnesota, there are over 775,000 student borrowers holding some $27 billion in debt. Those numbers are so big, they're hard to put in perspective. But I'll just remind members that we have about a $50 billion general fund budget that we manage every on a two-year cycle. So another way to looking at this is that the students of Minnesota owe enough money to operate the state of Minnesota's general fund for one whole year. The problem is also escalating quickly. Student debt increased by 127% between 2007 and 2017.
So I was on the phone trying to do this also, caucus thing, and I...
It's also a statewide problem. 51% of millennials in greater Minnesota report owing student debt, and a report from the Federal Reserve Bank identified student debt as the primary reason why young people choose to move from rural communities to the cities. Student loan debt is endlessly complex. There are a confusing labyrinth of repayment plans, forbearance options, and refinance opportunities. If a borrower makes even the slightest misstep, they can watch their debt balloon out of control and see themselves suddenly become ineligible for forgiveness programs that they may have planned their entire education around. Minnesota law is stunningly inadequate at protecting student borrowers from even the most basic bad behavior by the private companies that service their debt. And that's why I'm bringing forward this bill, a student borrower's bill of rights, designed to help ensure our students aren't misled or maltreated by their student loan servicers. This bill should help avoid catastrophic situations like the one that has developed around the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. This federal program, which has been in place since 2007, promises borrowers that if they work for a not-for-profit or a public service setting for 10 years, the federal government will forgive the balance of their loan. But when the first batch of borrowers applied for forgiveness, the federal government rejected over 95% of the applications. Thousands of applicants have been placed by their servicers onto the wrong payment plan to be eligible for the program, or engaged in a refinance that made themselves ineligible, or hadn't gotten their employment certified. 10 years and thousands of dollars of payments, all for naught. In a moment, you're going to hear from some testifiers who have some stories about how the student loan industry has impacted their lives. But I did want to highlight for the committee how thankful I am that this bill has been, and I hope will continue to be, a bipartisan endeavor. The Senate author, Senator Zach Duckworth, the bill has been through two committees in the House and received bipartisan support in both of them, including a 15-1 vote in the Judiciary Committee last week. It also passed unanimously through the Senate Higher Education Committee yesterday. So I'm grateful for that broad support and eager to continue to work with my colleagues across the aisle to continue to build support for this needed bill. And with that, Madam Chair, I believe I have a few testifiers.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. So the first on the list, I have Mr. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Mr. Elwood, could you introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and I am pleased to be here today to testify in strong support of House File 1493, the Student Borrow Bill of Rights. As you know, Legal Aid represents low-income Minnesotans, elder Minnesotans, and Minnesotans with disabilities across the state. The inclusion of services standards in particular in this bill would greatly benefit all students, but specifically the students who are clients of legal aid. Our clients are, of course, low income, but what may be surprising is they typically fall into two categories: older students and students who attend for-profit entities. In Minnesota, between 2012 and 2017, the number of student loan borrowers who are 60 years of age or older has increased by 46%. Nationally, the aggregate student debt among older borrowers has increased by more than 1,200%. And those students who are attending for-profit entities are less likely to graduate and have more student debt than those of public and private colleges. And finally, one other fact I think is important here. According to the United States Department of Education, borrowers of color and women borrowers struggle more to pay down their original student debts. House File 1493 has many excellent provisions, but I'd just like to highlight one of the most important. This bill would require an evaluation of whether the borrower was eligible for and informed about income-based loan repayment programs. Those programs are far more favorable to students than forbearance programs, to which many students are steered by unscrupulous servicers and which only serve to increase their debt. During the foreclosure crisis, Minnesota established standards for mortgage loan servicers, which created a fair playing field and helped eliminate adverse outcomes for homeowners. There is no reason why, given the student loan crisis, that similar standards should not be established for student loan borrowers. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 1493, and I urge the committee's support.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Next, we have Destiny Belmont. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson and committee members. My name is Destiny Belmont. I'm a school psychologist with Benton Stearns Education District, which is a special education cooperative in central Minnesota serving six school districts. There's an extreme shortage of school psychologists in Minnesota, especially in the greater Minnesota schools. I went to graduate school at Minnesota State University Moorhead for 3 years to obtain my master's and specialist degrees in school psychology. The program is 4 years of graduate studies condensed into three, so all students were strongly encouraged to not have jobs during enrollment. My journey to become a school psychologist was an expensive and arduous process. However, I had high hopes that I was going to make a difference in the lives of children and their families, and it would all be worth the effort. The cost of tuition was concerning, but I was made aware of the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program to ease my mind. I graduated in the spring of 2008 with $50,721.95 in student loans. I started making payments 6 months later. I vividly remember seeing only $1.83 of my first payment go towards principal. For more than 10 years, my loan servicer put me on several different payment plans, even though most of the time I never requested the changes. And for many of those payments, $0 went towards my principal. This caused me great stress and anguish as the financial burden never seemed to decrease. On April 5th, 2019, I applied for public service loan forgiveness for the first time. According to my records, I had made 120 payments and was finally eligible. 2 months later, I was denied. They told me I wasn't on the correct payment plan and I had only made 21 qualifying payments. I would not be eligible for another 8 years. I felt defeated. That same month, my loan was transferred and split into two different loans. The total, $51,056.72. This was more than $300 above what I had originally borrowed and had been paying off for over the past decade. I applied for loan forgiveness 5 more times, and I finally got into contact with a group of knowledgeable individuals who helped with this loan forgiveness, and I was given the right questions to ask of the customer service representatives. On August 19th, 2020, I was finally granted full forgiveness of my student loans. I took out $50,721.95 in student loans. I paid a total of $36,551.45. and I had $49,572.83 forgiven. Therefore, only $1,149.12 was applied towards my principal over the course of almost 12 years. This isn't right. Loan servicers are taking advantage of Minnesotans, many who, like myself, are going into education, healthcare, and other public services. It's time to regulate student loan servicers and represent the interest of borrowers, not corporations. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Belmont. Next, Heather Bakke. Please introduce yourself and state your name for the record. Do we have Ms. Bakke on the line?
I did not unmute. I apologize.
Not a problem. You were on my second page, so I found you there. Go right ahead.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Heather Bakke. I'm a high school special education teacher at Gibbon, Fairfax, Winthrop, Junior and Senior High School in Greater Minnesota. I am also the president of my local teachers union. GFW is located in Greater Minnesota, as I said, where we are not immune from the problems of recruiting and retaining teachers. In our district, the base salary for teachers is $38,034. And it makes it difficult to make ends meet. But in many of these teachers' cases, they are paying anywhere from $300 a month to more than $1,000 a month on student loans, basically another car payment or even a mortgage payment. So what does this mean for our teachers? Many are putting off life decisions like buying a home or having children. Others are working second or third jobs to make ends meet. These massive debt loads don't just affect the borrowers. Some of my colleagues who have paid off their own student loans are now trying to do what they can to ease the burden for their adult children. In 1995, I graduated from college with a social studies degree. At the time, I joked that the principal could throw a rock out the front door of the school and hit 10 social studies teachers. I struggled for years to find a permanent job. I did a lot of subbing assignments, including in Representative Davney's classroom in Buffalo. I got a variance to teach special education. I moved to Alaska to teach, and finally, I went back to school to get certified to teach special education. The good news is that I love being a special ed teacher. The bad news, during those years, I struggled to find a permanent job. I deferred my loans and added more interest to debt I couldn't afford to pay back. I've spent a lot of time and effort trying to figure out how to get these loans paid off. I consolidated my loans and I'm in the federal public service loan forgiveness program. The idea is that I will continue to work in my school and make payments for 10 years and my loans will be forgiven. Dealing with the loan service providers has made me wish that I would have gotten a legal degree as well to deal with all the paperwork. To have my loans forgiven through the federal program, I need to make 120 qualifying payments. When you look at your paperwork and the amount of payments you have made, it is never correct. Each month, you need to double and triple check to make sure they are crediting each payment towards the magic number of 120. In 2017, the first group of public service loan forgiveness enrollees should have had the rest of their loans forgiven, but less than 1% were actually approved. People who wondered where they had gone wrong were told again and again that there was a problem with their paperwork. These loan servicers are preying on borrowers, hoping they will just get tired of fighting and give up. That's why the Student Borrower Bill of Rights is so important. It would give teachers like me an advocate to help when I am getting the runaround from my loan company. It would help Minnesotans know their rights when it comes to their loans and offer assistance when there is a problem. Most importantly, it would require loan servicers to be licensed and have to adhere to standards or face consequences. I want to thank you for hearing my testimony and listening to my experience about student loans. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Backe. It takes a very special person to be a special ed teacher. That is all I have for the author's testifiers. So we will move to member discussion and questions. Members, any questions or discussion on House File 1493? Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the bill author. Are there any, for any other loan servicers, whether that's for consumer loans, auto loans, mortgaging, does the Commerce Department or the state of Minnesota currently have a licensing process for any of those servicers, or would this be kind of unique for the student loan industry?
Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rasmussen, the Commerce Department licensed a great number of lending institutions. Most significantly, of course, are banks, community banks, and credit unions, who generate a lot of the loans that you were just referencing. Can you remind me, you asked about specific institutions, and then I've already blanked on what the other ones were.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No worries, Representative Stevenson. I was more focused on the, because here it's my understanding of the word licensing, not necessarily the lending institutions, but actually the servicers of the loans. And so I was wondering if currently the Commerce or any other agency in the state of Minnesota has a licensing process for other loan servicers for auto loans, mortgages, et cetera.
Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Rasmussen, for clarifying. I misunderstood your question. I think one thing that's important to answer in that, and then I see Ms. Verdejas on the line from the Department of Commerce, and so I might punt to her to make sure I get the answer correctly. But the distinction that I would note, or I see Ms. Pompu's raising her hand, she might be able to answer as well. But the important distinction that I would point out is that the student loan industry is, I think, fairly unique in that, almost all student loan debt originates these days with the federal government. They are the lender, but they don't service the loans. There's these servicing companies that are otherwise unregulated, right? And in fact, the bill doesn't require a license. If you had an independent community bank or a community bank that offered a student loan, they wouldn't have to be licensed under this bill. This is only targeting servicing companies. And, I don't know that genre exists as much in, auto loans and other things. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But I think it's a kind of a unique phenomenon in the student loan industry. But I see Ms. Pompu is available, and I also see that Mr. Zappia from the Department of Commerce is available. So they might have a better answer than I do.
Chair and members, I just wanted to note that residential mortgage loan servicers are licensed by the Department of Commerce.
Thank you, Ms. Pompu. Mr. Chair, do you want any further follow-up on that?
Unless Mr. Zappia has anything to add to that, or Commissioner Zappia, I should say.
Commissioner Zappia?
Chair Stevenson, Representative Rasmussen, that's the best example we have. There's other license types that kind of servicing might result in an originator license, but for servicing, it would be the non-bank mortgage servicers.
Thank you for that. Representative Rasmussen, any follow-up?
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that information. I very much appreciate it, and thank you, Representative Stevenson, for bringing forward this discussion on the student loan situation. It's something can you hear me? Great. It's something that I think is a really important issue across Minnesota, and so I'm glad we're talking about it today. The one caution that I have is we've heard a lot of talk from the new Biden administration on actions that they might take at a national level through the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau when it comes to these loan servicers. And they've underscored a lot of the issues that Representative Stevenson and the testifiers have brought up today. And so I worry about us kind of creating this parallel state infrastructure and just worry that that could maybe unnecessarily add costs to our student loan process that could potentially get passed on to student borrowers. But I do appreciate the discussion, and I think it's something we should continue to talk about. I just personally think that we should wait and see what the Biden administration is going to do and what the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau actions could take for a national framework for protecting student borrowers who find themselves in really challenging situations. But I appreciate the discussion today. That's all I have, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Stevenson. I have similar concerns as Representative Rasmussen just asked, but also a few questions. Representative Stevenson, how many loan servicers operate in the state of Minnesota today? What's the scope of this universe that you are trying to regulate?
Chair Stevenson.
The Madam Chair, Representative Haley, the fiscal note for the bill identifies that there's 20 entities that would probably be subject to licensing under this bill. As I kind of alluded in my answer to Representative Rasmussen, there are other financial institutions that are already regulated that would not be subject to this bill, like banks, community banks, credit unions.
Representative Haley.
Thank you. And Chair Stevenson, I noticed that the U of M is not included in this list. And are they a loan servicer? Are other higher education institutions also servicers?
Chair Stevenson?
You know, Representative Haley, that provision was added last biennium to this bill, and I might have to get back to you on that one. My recollection, and I don't know if there's someone else on the call who or on the Zoom who has a better answer than this, but my recollection is that they have a program that they that isn't really loan servicing. It's like offering advice to students about how to manage debt, that they were concerned would fall under this, and so that's why we exempted them. They're not actually servicing loans, but they're like helping guide students. And as I recall, that's the purpose for that exclusion.
Thank you.
And Chair Stevenson, another question. Is your language patterned after any other states that took similar action, and do you know how many other states have done this? Kind of along the lines of Representative Rasmussen's questions, if the federal government is looking at something that would be universally applied, I'm kind of wondering how you landed on your language and if it was patterned after any other states that are doing the same work.
Chair Stevenson.
Thanks for that question, Representative Haley. Yes, there are a number of other states that have taken this approach. I recall when Colorado passed this bill last biennium, Maryland has done it. I know there are other states beyond that. I don't have the total number on, again, if there's someone else on the Zoom who might have that answer, I would defer to them. But I know there are a number of states that have done so. I did, in terms of developing the language, we did slim the bill down a little bit this year from where it was 2 years ago, tried to listen to the concerns that my colleagues on the Republican side had raised and addressed them in the bill this year, which is why I'm pleased it's garnered such bipartisan support so far.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Representative Haley, any further questions?
Yes, I just had kind of some closing comments. Thank you, Madam Chair. I still have some questions on the bill, Representative Stevenson, but appreciate your work on it. This is a significant issue. I just wanted to remind committee members as well that we have done things in the past to support student borrowers. I was, in fact, chief author of a First in the Nation bill back in 2017 where we provided student loan tax credits. And that is still in our tax code and something that I also think we should expand on. We also had a bill that was included in the 2018 omnibus that provided student loan debt counseling. And I had done a significant research at that time on that bill and identified the kind of subset of borrowers that were struggling the most and really successful free counseling that we could provide that specifically guided them through how to work with the loan servicers and restructure their loans. And so that might be something as well that we can go back and look at. And additionally, I think, and this is maybe more way on the front end, but I believe that Representative Erdahl has a bill moving through this session that includes financial studies as part of high school curriculum. I think that's something that we hear often, that we've lost that in our high school curriculum. And not directly associated with this, but I think just a piece of the puzzle. So I appreciate your work on it. Wanted to remind folks that you know, we've taken bites out of this with past legislation, and there's some other things that we can probably look at. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Haley. And per the speaker's instruction, we are going to recess now to the call of the chair. It will not be earlier than 6 p.m. I see Representative Lucero, Representative O'Driscoll, and I believe Representative Dabney also had their hands raised. So we will follow up with member questions at that time. So we will use the original 6 p.m. Zoom link that was sent out originally, and we will see you a little bit later.
Before you go, Madam Chair, DFL members, please, you got an email about a very, very brief caucus I would like us to do right at the start of the recess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are in recess. Welcome back, everyone. I will call this secondary meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Vice Chair Katiza Watoon.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll present.
Representative Barr. Representative Carlson. Representative Dabney. Representative Elkins. Representative Haley.
Present.
Representative Cagle. Representative Lee. Present. Thank you.
Lee present.
Thank you. Representative Lilly.
Lilly present.
Representative Liz Lagarde. Representative Lucero. Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Richardson. Representative Tice.
Present.
Representative Barr.
Here.
Representative Carlson. Representative Dabney.
Present.
Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Liz Lagarde. Representative Lucero. Representative Richardson.
I'm in on here. Carlson present.
Thank you.
Very well, there is a quorum present. And so, members, we went into recess in the member discussion and questions section of Chair Stevenson's bill 1493. And we had Representative O'Driscoll up first.
Madam Chair, a couple of things. Number one, there is, Representative Lucero had asked me to have his hand lowered. He did not want to ask a question at this point, and he will be arriving shortly. He late leaving caucus and needed to join us in a little bit. My thoughts are more comments, I think, than they're going to be questions for the bill author. I do understand a couple of things. Number one, students who are seeking student loans to a differing degree, and I realize that the jurisdiction of what we're looking at in this committee isn't really higher education, but I think it ties very closely back to the fiscal issues that we're looking at here and that testifiers were talking about. Chief among them, I don't know that students are getting the full exposure in high school or even younger to different career opportunities. And as a result of that, they may not be finding what works best for them and where their interests are and a chance to explore and to work on things. There's a tremendous amount of peer pressure for individuals to go to college, to a four-year college, whether it's parental or family pressures, including peer pressure from their classmates. They may be taking a pass on military options. They're taking a pass on the trades. As it stands right now, trades options are very, very limited in high school. By the time a student would learn about maybe their interest in those areas, they've gone to their freshman year in college, maybe gone back for their sophomore year, and then the call comes in October to mom and dad, I've dropped out of college with a heaping amount of debt. Then they begin to look at a trade school or some other kind of a career path where they're still going to need to be incurring student loans. They're so far behind already as a result of that, and being able to get a jump start on their new vocation or what means a lot to them. I think that this will also help us to reduce some of the things that Representative Stevenson's bill is attempting to try to resolve. think it's also important to look at the fact that the nominee in the Biden administration for the office of the CFPB, the Financial Services Board, is making this a priority. Has talked about this being something that the federal government should be being involved with. So I don't know that it's completely necessary at the state level, since the Biden administration is looking at this. And the candidate that they're looking at is actually someone who is a first ombudsman for under the Dodd-Frank Act that dealt with the student loan debacle. So it appears that we maybe have someone who has some experience in this at the federal level, and so more students can benefit. And as a result, I'm not 100% sure how much work we need to continue to do at the state level on it. So as I said, Madam Chair, I don't know that I have any necessarily questions for the bill author. I just wanted to share some observations and experiences of things that are happening that surround the nature of this bill. I do thank the chair for bringing the bill, and Representative Stevenson, the chair, for bringing it forward, and I'm chair for the time to be able to share my thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Chair Stevenson, would you have anything to follow up with that on? Otherwise, if we don't have any other member questions, thank you for sharing. Representative Lucero would like to lower his hand. I suppose, Chair Stevenson, you can have the last word.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just briefly say that, you know, I think that it's an interesting comment first raised by Representative Rasmussen and Representative Driscoll about the CFB and the national level. I think, you know, they have a hopeful and optimistic view of what the federal government will accomplish. In my experience, relying on the federal government to do anything is usually not productive use of time. They don't typically aren't able to get much done, it feels like. And the nominee for the CFB is just that, a nominee, not confirmed. And regulations take time to propose, and we don't know how they turn out. So I would hope that we could move forward with protecting our students instead of hoping that the situation would get better down the road due to federal action that is not a guarantee. But I appreciate the conversation, the discussion. As I have mentioned repeatedly, you know, this is a bill that I've worked really hard to try and garner support from both sides of the aisle, and we've been successful as the committee has moved through the committee process. So I'll ask for everyone's support as we continue to move the bill forward, but that doesn't mean that we're done working on it, and I'm happy to continue the conversation. And with that, I guess I would renew my motion that House File 1493, as amended, be re-referred to Ways and Means.
All right. Chair Stevenson renews his motion that House File 1493, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cotizza-Watoon.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Representative Dabney.
Dabney, aye.
Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Representative Haley.
No.
Representative Cagle. Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Liz Lagarde. Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
No.
And Representative Cagle.
Aye. There being 10 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 1493, as amended, is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. So I will now go ahead and hand the virtual gavel back to Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Chair Cotizza-Watoon, for your able service. Our next bill is one we've heard before that's come back after some work has been done, Representative Dabney's bill. House File 1067. Representative Dabney, would you like to move your bill? I think you're muted, Representative Dabney.
Some people prefer me that way, Mr. Chair.
Not me.
Not when I'm presenting a bill?
Whatever.
Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to move House File 1067 to be before the committee and referred to the general register, I believe is.
That's correct. Representative Dabney moves House File 1067 be recommended and placed on the general register. And Representative Dabney, you have an amendment. Would you like to move your amendment?
I do. Mr. Chair, I'm having just a little bit of technical difficulty. There it is. I'd like to move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form that I prefer, sir.
Representative Dabney moves the A1. Any discussion to the A1? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Dabney, I don't know if you want to explain the changes that you've made to the bill and sort of refresh our recollection as to what the bill is about.
Well, let me just be brief here, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for that vote. When this bill was before us, it allows financial institutions that are regulated by the state to, if they choose on a voluntary basis, to establish programs to work with unbanked people who may have gotten in trouble with their use of their checking accounts in the past. As a part of that bill and the part that attracted some attention was a old reference to a limit on $4 for charges for overcharges. And working with stakeholders, we initially deleted that language so the cap would float to a reasonable expectation, which comes from other regulations that they're governed by. Folks were a little uncomfortable with that. Stakeholders have agreed to a $10 maximum fee. That $4 fee had not been adjusted for many, many years. And so this functionally is an adjustment to reflect inflation from the time it was first put into place. With me today is Ryan Smith from the Minnesota Credit Union Network. If he may wish to speak or simply stand for questions if members have them.
And Mr. Smith, anything you wanted to add now or just questions?
Mr. Chair, I said the last time I'm all about brevity in your committee. Happy to answer any member questions.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. That's why you're one of our very favorite testifiers. Any discussion to House File 1067? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Dabney, for accommodating that request with regards to the limit in your amendment. I'm glad that you're able to work it out. So thank you, Chair Dabney.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Dabney, for the bill. So as the president of a state bank, I appreciate this and gives us the option to make that decision on our own. So a good bill. I will be supporting it. Thank you.
Any further discussion to House File 1067? Seeing none, Representative Dabney, would you like to renew your motion and make any closing comments?
I renew my motion that House File 1067 be referred to the general register, and I think the less said, the better. The momentum seems to be on my side, Mr. Chair.
I tend to agree. Representative Dabney renews the motion that House File 1067 as amended be recommended to be placed on the general register, and Mr. Brown will take the roll and chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Cortez-Wortoon.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Representative O'Driscoll, aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Representative Dabney.
Dabney, aye.
Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Representative Haley.
Haley, aye.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Thank you. Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
Tice, aye.
With 17 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 1067 as amended is recommended to be placed on the general register. The next bill on our agenda is House File 1433. Representative Frederickson, welcome to the committee. As a bit of background, we will be laying this bill over for probably just a brief stay in this committee as Representative Frederick is working with stakeholders and anticipates an amendment that we wanted to make sure we gave the committee enough time to consider before asking for a vote. So we will probably be taking up the bill again next week. I want to share further with the committee that we did obtain an opinion from House Research that this bill has met deadline.
in the House, has met first deadline in the House. So laying it over will not impact its progress going forward. And that, again, is per House research. Representative O'Driscoll, did you have some questions you wanted to ask us in my sort of opening statement?
Yes, sir? Mr. Chair, I just wanted to underscore the fact that, and just make sure so that we can help you manage in a civil and reasonable fashion as well from our end, how you want to do this tonight. I know that there are a number of public testifiers that are going to be here. We do have the amendment coming. We'd be happy this evening to hear from the testifiers and the public, and then hear from the amendment, and then hold our discussion on the bill until all information that was before this committee is in, before maybe start having a discussion on parts or different parts of the bill. Can I defer to you, Mr. Chair, but that is what we're willing to do this evening.
Yeah, thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. My intention is to have the testimony tonight. I don't know that we'll even discuss amendment right now because, as I mentioned, Representative Frederick is continuing to work with stakeholders. But if members have questions or comments they want to make about the bill as it exists now, certainly open to that. Members will have the opportunity to address the bill when it comes back, just as we did with Representative Dabney's bill, Representative. There have been other bills that have come back that now it's, you know, at the point of the night where I lose my train of thought. But as is our normal practice, I will say that I will not be accepting additional testimony on the bill when we come back, except as to the whatever amendment emerges. But if members have questions or comments tonight, they are welcome to make them. And with that, Representative O'Driscoll, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the clarification, and that certainly sounds like a workable plan for us as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. And with that, I will move that House File 1433 be laid over for further consideration. Representative Frederick, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm going to be super brief. My internet, even though I'm here in the office, is just all sorts of weird. Like, I'm having people talk on top of each other. So I'm going to go for super, super quick. This bill establishes an E15 standard. The whole goal of it is to support farmers throughout Minnesota and support the agricultural community. Minnesota was the first state to establish an E10 standard. Throughout the state already today, you can go and find lots and lots of gas stations that already have E15 gasoline. And so this bill would be an effort to further that along. E15 also has the benefit of reducing carbon emissions for those who are looking for that as well. But ultimately, it's to support the farmers and support our agricultural community. And with that, I would turn it over to the department.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. I didn't have someone from the department on the list, but if there's someone from Commissioner Peterson, you are welcome to testify.
Okay, Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Tom Peterson. I serve as Commissioner of Agriculture, and great to join you tonight. I'll just make a few brief comments, and then I'll turn it over to Bob Patton from the department to hit some of the main points of the bill, if that works. Real quick, I really appreciate that this came out, bill really is came out of a recommendation that our governor's biofuel task force put together. And the governor in September of 2019 signed an executive order to help promote biofuels and specifically E15. And so we're really pleased that this bill is coming to fruition and moving through the process. And I'm not going to reiterate a lot of the good things that Representative Frederick stated, and really appreciate him carrying this bill. As he stated, Minnesota has always been a leader in ethanol. In fact, and continue at the blending rate of 12.49% gallons in our gasoline right now. We do lead the nation currently in blending of ethanol. And so we see this as an opportunity, as we said, great for our farmers, great for our rural communities, but also great for reducing our carbon emissions. And so we see that as a real positive. And with that, with time being short, I want to turn it over to Bob Patton, who can make some comments on the bill.
Mr. Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Bob Patton with Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I thought I'd very briefly walk through the bill. I know you'll be taking up an amendment next week. So Section 1 provides a minimum compatibility standard for new equipment. It's a standard up to 15% ethanol, and it does allow for change of that standard as new blend certifications are established. Section 2 provides is the new content standard. It allows it has the standard go up to 15% no sooner than 2023 and no later than 2026. There is a striking of some of a timeline for there had been in the current statute, there's a timeline for conventional biofuel, which is cornstarch ethanol versus advanced biofuel, and had a minimum content of conventional biofuel that goes down over time, and that's stricken. The main thing is that the content standard, this is on page 3, the content standard only goes into place when the four commissioners of Agriculture, Commerce, Transportation, Pollution Control determine that four conditions have been met. One has to do with standards, one has to do with approval by the content standard by the EPA. The other two have to do with readiness of infrastructure, which is really one of the main issues facing delivery of new of the higher blends. One is just that the distributors have the time available to be able to install compatible infrastructure, and the fourth condition is that distributors who are small, two or fewer distribution locations, are have the opportunity to obtain financial assistance. Most of the rest up to subdivision 17 or section 7 are mostly technical. Section 7, which is on page 5, exempts vehicles. It provides an exemption for selling E10 for vehicles that aren't approved for E15. That would be vehicles that are 2000 and older, 2000 model year and older. Section 8 provides an exemption from the blending standard for, again, small distributors, two or fewer locations. And then there's a rulemaking requirement in Section 9 on page 6. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Patton. We do, Representative Frederick, I know you have a few other testifiers on the list here. Would you like me to introduce them, or would you like to introduce them?
Feel free, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Frederick. The first testifier is Brian Thalman of the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. Mr. Thalman.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Thalman. I serve on the board of directors of the Minnesota Corn Growers Association, and I'm here today on behalf of MCGA and our nearly 6,500 members to support House File 1433. Thank you, Representative Frederick, for bringing this bill forward. I raise corn and soybeans on my family farm near Plato with my father and son. We also operate a seed cleaning and sales business and work closely with local farmers. My family has been involved with Heartland Corn Products Cooperative Ethanol Facility in Winthrop for over 20 years. I currently serve on the board of directors. Production began there in 1995 and has grown to 120 million gallons of ethanol annually. The cooperative provides a vital market for corn produced by the 900 farmer member owners. Innovation at the facility continues to provide added value to the corn our family delivers. At an ethanol plant, the amazing corn kernel, as I like to call it, provides ethanol from the starch while also providing protein-rich dry distiller's grain for livestock and corn oil, all from the same kernel at the same time. The ethanol industry is crucial to farmers' economic vitality while providing multiple benefits to Minnesota's consumers, communities, and the economy. Ethanol is a cleaner burning fuel that helps to improve air quality by reducing particulate emissions and has lower carbon emissions compared to gasoline, allowing the entire tank of gas to burn cleaner. Minnesota has long been a national leader in biofuels policy. We were the first state to require ethanol blended fuels back in 1997 and have made additional strides since then. Minnesota leads the nation in the number of retail stations that offer higher blends of ethanol. We can continue that leadership by moving to a 15% standard blend. Some may ask if our state has sufficient production of corn and ethanol to meet a new 15% standard. Yes, we absolutely do. After the 15% standard is enacted, we would still be exporting over two-thirds of our ethanol to customers beyond Minnesota's borders. Thank you for your time, and I appreciate your support of this House file.
Thank you. The next testifier is Gary Warish of the Minnesota Farmers Union. Mr. Warish.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. And I'd like to thank Representative Frederick for bringing this bill forward. You know, I'm president of Minnesota Farmers Union. I farm in western Minnesota. I assist my son with his farming operation in western Minnesota, Randall County. The ethanol, and Brian just mentioned, you know, in 1997 we passed the ethanol ETN standard. You know, that's been a huge economic driver for the whole state of Minnesota, not only providing jobs in rural communities, but tax dollars that have gone back into the state that the state has been able to use, whether it's for education or healthcare, you know, the various programs throughout the state. The, you know, there's a lot of focus now on moving into the electric vehicles that we're going to be turning over to electric vehicle society. Just, and I agree, as we move, as technology improves in battery storage and in electric vehicles, we will move there at some point. But we are not going to be moving into that tomorrow. You know, it's going to take time to build that out, and it's going to take time to increase that technology. You know, we have a viable renewable fuels industry by the ethanol, and by increasing the going from a 10% mandate or standard to a 15% standard, we're going to remove a lot more toxins that are in the from gasoline toxins out of the air. So you're going to be cleaning up the air. So it's going to benefit the whole state of Minnesota. You know, it's going to, the cleaner air is really going to benefit the metro, the urban communities where you have more populated people living in, you know, densely populated, and also more traffic, you know, as you're going by the streets. So it's the huge advantage of the clean air is going to go into the more densely populated areas. You know, we can have both. You know, we can have electric, we can move to that. But right now, the biofuels industry and ethanol industry in particular, according on this bill by Representative Frederick, we have that right now. We can provide the benefits to the whole state of Minnesota by cleaner air. And it lowers the price at the pump, too. So this provides benefits to everybody. Representative Frederick said the bill was to help farmers. But I'd like to point out it not only helps farmers. It does help everybody by lowering the price of fuel at the pump, consumers, and cleaning up the air. So with that, I'll just, you know, like to thank you for your time, and thank you, Representative Frederick, for bringing the bill forward. So thank you, committee.
Thank you, Mr. Warish. The next testifier is Kevin Popp of the Farm Bureau. Mr. Popp?
Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Popp. I'm president of the Minnesota Farm Bureau, a general farm organization made up of 78 local farm bureaus with nearly 30,000 members. Minnesota Farm Bureau today is testifying in support of Representative Frederick's House File 1433. Now, being the fourth generation in our family and farming with my son, the fifth generation, and having the sixth generation living a half mile down the road, sustainability is a priority in everything we do. A big part of sustainability, including generational sustainability, is the ability to add value to our commodities. Animal agriculture and renewable fuels are two of the best ways to add value to our farms and our rural communities. As the state's largest general farm organization, we represent many different types of farms, farm commodities, and farm animals. You know, when we think about ethanol, we've got to remember that only part of the corn kernel is used to make the nearly 3 gallons of ethanol out of a bushel of corn. That bushel also produces over 16 pounds of livestock feed. We call them DDGs, as well as corn distillers oil, and in many cases, carbon dioxide. You know, we will probably never stop calling them ethanol plants, but we need to remember ethanol plants produce more than fuel. There are other important co-products, including livestock feed. You know, climate solutions are a priority at the local, state, and national level with Farm Bureau. Minnesota is a leader, has been mentioned, in renewable fuels. Let's build on our history and be the first state to move to a year-round E15 standard and enable farmers to do our part in growing and producing a cleaner burning, higher octane fuel that reduces greenhouse gases. The increased use of renewable fuels by moving to an E15 standard is the fastest way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in our state. This is something we can and we should do as soon as possible. Thank you for your time. I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you. That's the conclusion of the author's testifiers. We do have two members of the public who signed up to testify. The first testifier is Mr. Frank Horton from the Petroleum Marketers Association. Mr. Horton.
Yeah, my name is Frank Horton with Horton Oil Company here in Walker, Minnesota. And I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. I'm part of a third-generation family business here in northern Minnesota. We're a small chain of 14 convenience stores, 13 of which are in Minnesota, as well as supplying approximately a dozen independent convenience stores in northern Minnesota. We employ about 150 employees within our business. I guess from my standpoint, I don't particularly have any issue with E15 and, you know, the benefits to the environment that have been put forth. I think the issue that we as an industry have is the infrastructure readiness and the cost to upgrade the infrastructure and the lack of support financially within this bill to get us there. In the absence of any financial support, our underground storage tank upgrade to E15, it's very hard to support this type of bill. Without support, I think you're going to see many marketers either sell their business because it's not worth the upgrade or just have to close. Now, I understand that there's a carve-out for small businesses, which, you know, one or two stores, believe me, that, you know, there's a lot of us that have more than two stores that feel we're small businesses. You know, I don't think we're Quick Trip or Holiday with 13 stores. There appears to be no financial support for what I believe is a small chain. I can tell you from experience, cost remediation, depending on the extent, whether it's piping or a full UST system, could be anywhere from $100,000 to $500,000 per site. You could take that for whether it's a one store or 13 stores, it's a big number. For our company, it could be in excess of $1 million. According to the state, 85% of the facilities need some upgrade that are not capable of handling E15. Some estimates that I've seen are showing that is over $750 million as an industry within the state of Minnesota. It's not like at the end of this deal, we're going to sell more gas and recoup that investment. The timeline is very short. I think we all understand that there's a push both federally and statewide for the electric vehicle. So the time horizon, if there were any recouping of our investment, it's just not out there. I mean, we're going to see a decline in gallons moving forward and whatnot. So you couple that with the poor timing in general of the COVID pandemic forcing the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers into a $750 million underground storage system upgrade. I think what you're going to see is a lot of people just either forced to sell their business or to shutter it. And we have plenty of that going on as it is. In some, you know, forcing massive expenditures on our industry for albeit maybe a good idea with zero financial support, you're essentially asking myself and other petroleum marketers in the state to shoulder the sole burden of this cost of the upgrade to help out our friends in the agricultural industry, which believe me, I have no problem with farmers selling more ethanol and having a propped up demand for that. But we can't shoulder the full brunt of the cost of this, at least not if you want us to be around, you know. So if there's any questions or comments, I'm free to handle those as needed.
Thank you, Mr. Orton. The last public testifier is Wade Carlson of Wally Carlson and Sons. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to this. I appreciate the time that you've given me, Mr. Chairman, and others on the group. I'm the opposite of Frank. I'm a small distributor. We've been selling petroleum products as our company since 1953, and I've been part of the company for 45 years. So I have some experience in this and gone through a lot of changes over the years, going through the E10 and other things. I won't repeat a lot of the stuff from Frank, what he talked about, the cost. I might fall into that category where I'm a small operator with one or two locations and would receive some financial assistance and upgrading, but I don't know what those costs are. I know what the costs are. I have some estimates of $325,000 to $500,000 just for my one station. And as Frank said, I won't sell any more gasoline by doing the upgrade. Matter of fact, like he said, our chances of selling less gasoline over the next 5 to 10 years are going to probably decline unless we have other businesses going out of business in our area. And I have three of the big boys real close within 2 miles of my location. And our focus over these years have been to serve the customer, the local customer that we have. And we have many, many, many loyal customers. And that's been one of our prime objectives, is to serve our community and be involved in our community. The holidays, the quick trips, the Casey's, I see very little community involvement from those companies. And we've been a big supporter of our communities over the years. And so we really need, if this is going to work, I'm not opposed to ethanol. We were one of the first to put E10 in and did our upgrades at that time, which wasn't nearly as much money as it is today to do it, to E15, because our tanks could accept it at that time on our piping. Now we don't know what it's going to accept. So it's a huge investment. So I am not in support of this bill the way it stands presently. We feel as an association and myself that we need to be some kind of support financially to help us to make these upgrades, to have the proper tanks, the proper piping in the ground and above ground to satisfy the customer and meet their needs. And so it's been a real privilege to be able to share this with you. If you have any questions, I would be open to taking those right now.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. That's the end of our public testimony. So we, as I alluded to, we'll have time for member discussion and questions. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question for Commissioner Peterson. Commissioner Peterson, thank you for spending some of, I think it's Wednesday, evening with us. I was wondering, thinking about this bill, does the Department of Agriculture involve itself with water quality monitoring? I know that southern Minnesota has some significant challenges with water quality. I believe pregnant people are advised not to eat fish out of the waters of southern Minnesota. I think the rest of us are encouraged not to eat the fish out of the waters of southern Minnesota as well. I know that, if I remember correctly, we're all encouraged not to swim in the waters of southern Minnesota. So I'm just wondering, does the Department of Agriculture involve itself with monitoring water quality?
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Dabney, we do, and that's kind of a broad statement, you know, on the swimmable and fishable waters. But yes, there is an issue with waters that we've been working on for many years. We do testing, both well sampling and issues like that. And you know, I think that we are taking a proactive approach on many fronts on this. Not to get super technical on it, but after many years, we put in a nitrogen fertilizer management rule that really looks at our groundwater and is really proactive on teams that we're working on. We've been taking steps with our agricultural water certification program that upgrades, and farmers are making upgrades to their farms. We just signed up our 1,000th farmer for that, as well as quick adoption of cover crops. So we're seeing a lot of changes in the landscape. Keep in mind, you know, we're really talking about corn here. Corn is a predominant crop in Minnesota, as soybeans are throughout southern Minnesota. And corn's going to continue to be a predominant crop in southern Minnesota. If you look at, just take a county like, say, Redwood County, grows over 200,000 acres of corn, which many counties in southern Minnesota do. For example, our hemp industry, which is really starting to take off as a third crop with over 500 farmers growing, we've only got to about 8,000 acres is the tops that we permitted on that. So when we're looking at, you know, changing our landscape or doing different things, we're going to continue to grow corn in Minnesota for a long time. And so our challenge and what I think we're rising to, and kind of to, I think to your point, is that, you know, farmers are improving and recognizing our groundwater situations and trying to get at that. So that's kind of a long answer, but, you know, I just want you to know that we are taking steps and we do.
Representative. Mr. Chair, I probably have more questions to follow up, but I do recognize that you've been indulgent. I'm getting, I think, just a little bit outside the jurisdiction of this committee. So I'll stop there, but thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for the bill author or perhaps any other testifier here today, but in the Governor's Council on Biofuels Infrastructure Committee's report from just this last November, fairly recent report, they had in their findings section that they believe that it would take 10 years to upgrade the infrastructure in Minnesota to a E15 compatibility standards. And so I was wondering, Representative Frederick, if you could explain why we give, you know, the industry, it's my understanding, just 5 years to update everything, given that the governor's report in November talked about it taking actually 10 years to be able to make the upgrades necessary for this transition.
I wonder if that's a question that Commissioner Peterson wants to take or Representative Frederick. Commissioner Peterson looks like he's reaching for his mute. I don't know.
I can answer, but I see if Representative Frederick wanted to say anything first. Otherwise, I can. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Rasmussen. Yes, and, you know, I think that was, you know, really to getting to look at, to cut to the chase because time is short is one of the reasons, too, that I think we're holding it here in the committee today as we're looking at this. The Agriculture Committee, you know, originally when we looked at that was in our report, we decided to start soon, but after visiting, you know, with some of the testifiers today and really looking at, you know, we are really looking at, to cut to the chase, the funding parts of this and also the timing on this. And so recognizing that is something that we're continuing to work on. And I appreciate the chair, you know, giving us some time to work on this and also the author. But, you know, you did kind of hit it there is that is the issue that we are looking at and trying to work in. What is reasonable with those stations? And that's one of the things that we will continue to work on.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and appreciate the answer, Commissioner, on that. And I'm glad to hear that you'll be working on the language. And I hope that that deadline is extended significantly to reflect you know, what was put together as a part of the Governor's Council and that it reflects those recommendations because I am concerned about the costs and the timing for, you know, businesses here in Minnesota. I was wondering, you know, since we have the testifiers on here today, you know, if someone could just talk about why a mandate is required. We had a number of folks talk about the advantages of ethanol, you know, from a cost perspective and other items, you know, why a mandate is actually required for the industry to move up to E15.
Representative Frederick, do you want to go first on that or Commissioner Peterson?
I'll just put up something quick on there and pass it off. So already throughout the state, you know, why is the mandate required? Because we're already seeing E15 throughout the state. I will also say to your last question as well with the timeframes, there are already stations out there that have the equipment that would be able to roll this out right away. And so it's trying to find, you know, making sure that we support them in doing that, but then also giving people enough time to actually, you know, make those changes over. Why make the mandate for E15? There's already an effort going on. There's a desire from the corn farmers and our agricultural community to be able to say, hey, this is happening. What can we do to support it? And they thought that this would be a good way to support both of those communities. But otherwise, I will pass it off to the commissioner.
Commissioner Peterson, do you have a brief answer beyond that?
You know, I would just echo what Representative Frederick said. Somebody who's worked in this for very long, I would say that they've worked in Minnesota. As I said, that we've been a leader, we built the industry, whether you're an ethanol fan or not, you cannot argue that we have not built a strong industry in Minnesota and supported our farmers and rural communities through this. As I said, like, we are good at growing corn, we grow a lot of corn, you know, and I think it's interesting now to see some of our foreign countries, like the UK, China. We just shipped three vessels of ethanol to China this week. The UK is going to E10. There's, we see this happening around the globe, as well as in other parts of this the country as well. And so I would argue that they've worked well and served Minnesota well. But I think Mr. Thalman might be a good person also just add a line or two about this.
Mr. Thalman, if you can, very, very briefly, please.
Great. Yes, thank you, Commissioner. I served on the Biofuels Council, and I guess I would sum it up by saying we've had a mandate for 100 years to use petroleum products, and the ag and rural industry, a rural renewable fuel industry, just wants a chance to have a seat at the table. And with the clout and so on, the farmer, a consumer goes to the gas station, we haven't had any other choices. So this would allow to get this renewable product out there, and then to follow up on the other question earlier is, you know, we just really think that the ability of ethanol to create value is great. Back to the tank situation, again, the council, we had a discussion on the storage tanks, and there were some fairly preliminary numbers put together by the Pollution Control Agency, but more exact numbers are being put together. And I believe all the members of the committee have gotten information from the American Lung Institution that indicates that the vast majority of tanks, for example, are compatible. So as we drill down the numbers, the cost is going to be less than the $750 million, I'm firmly convinced. And the industry, corn industry and so on, will be putting some money towards this tool so we can find a way to accomplish their goals.
Thank you. Representative Reston, if you have anything really brief, there's a number of members seeking recognition. The bill's coming back around, so I just don't want to stick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the answers, and I'll hold some of my additional questions for when we revisit the bill, but I appreciate the time today.
Thank you, Representative Reston. Representative O'Driscoll.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure, but maybe some of the other people who have questions tonight may also benefit from the question I'm going to ask on here, and that's to the bill author. Representative Frederick, you're working on an amendment, and this bill is going to be laid over. Can you give the committee some kind of maybe higher-level overview of what it is that your amendment might be looking at doing so that we
can... You know, Representative O'Driscoll, I'm just going to interject and say that I think that in the interest of having a good, candid stakeholder discussion, we don't typically do that when we are laying bills over and having those stakeholder conversations. I think it's best that we have those, and when there's an amendment ready, we can consider it in the committee.
Oh, I guess I would have thought that if we wanted members to be prepared and knowing what's coming, to not ask questions on stuff that might be taken out of the bill next week, that we wouldn't use committee time tonight to have that conversation. But it is the prerogative of the chair. So that was my question, was to know what we should be preparing for and asking questions on. But if it's going to be a big target, we don't know for sure what's coming next week, I guess we can continue. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And we certainly will post the amendment with ample time for members to be prepared. This has been our practice. One of the reasons why we're laying it over is that we wanted to make sure that we had the opportunity for members to be prepared. And I don't think it's a good idea to be talking about a moving target when there's still conversations going on and have the public be misinformed about what might happen down the road. So we'll let those conversations continue, just as we did with bills both by Democrats and Republicans. and we will come back to it next week. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I grew up in the oil business. My family owned a gas station in Watkins, and I have always kind of kept a little bit of track of what's happening, and now a cousin of mine owns a station, and I'm thinking, holy smokes, guys, there's no way he could afford to do anything like this, and I don't even know that he would want to. He's in central Minnesota, very small town. There's about 800 people there, a lot of farmers there, and I don't see him wanting this at all. But some of the things I've really been aware of as one of my sons is in the motorcycle industry is that they don't even come close to using anything like this. And, you know, that's kind of good because my understanding is that E15 is not even really liked very well in the summertime. We don't see it as much. So it's only kind of a winter fuel. So it sounds like something that we're asking people to make huge investments for something that probably won't even be used all year. In fact, I don't even know that I've even seen it. We don't use it in our lawnmowers and things like that. And I know that the Outdoor Power Equipment Institute has said, you know, this is just really bad stuff for us and we don't see it. That's really hard for me to get behind a bill like this, which I would love to do, since we also know that our farmers need a lot of work on this as well. I mean, they're going to put a lot of investment in this, and it makes really good sense. But when I talk to my son, who works a lot with Indian, Harley, BMW, his take on it is, yeah, it's just like moonshine. It doesn't work well. It gums up. It does this. It does that. It burns high. And I'm not really sure that, you know, you'd go through it a little bit quicker. It burns clean. But is it really going to make that much of a difference? And since we're also talking about some of the California car standards, you know, how long would we even be looking at using E15? And if we're going to have everybody gin up to this, then what are we going to do when it's not there? And are we providing some types of programs for folks that will upgrade their tanks? But are they really going to do it if it's a short fix? I mean, I've heard it said once the, you know, electric vehicles are standard, we're not going to see a lot of gasoline products, including E15. So I really have a really, really hard time with this. And I guess I'd like to hear a little bit, like with the folks that do have flex vehicles and use flex fuel, how have they been working so far? And are they, doing some research on this and learning that it isn't really good in the summertime? You know, what is happening to a lot of the engines?
You know, and Representative Tice, are you asking that question to someone in particular, or are you
to anyone that wants to answer it? I don't know.
And I am thinking, as usual, I will give the first crack to Representative Frederick and Representative Peterson. I don't know if there's someone else on the call who has a good sense of it, but Representative Frederick.
So to the point of electric vehicles, I'm just going to put out real quick. So I'm on the Transportation Committee, and there's been lots of conversations about electric vehicles. Majority of those conversations talk about that the rollover for mass adoption of electric vehicles is going to be 20, 30 plus years out. You know, that there's not some like light switch that someone's going to go flip and all of a sudden we're all going to have electric vehicles in our garage. I mean, if there is that light switch out there, let me know where it is. I'd love to be able to drive around and I think it'd be fun, but we have lots of time before that eventually comes to be, as even our testifiers have alluded to, that there's a long time between now and when the majority of the vehicles on the road are electric vehicles. But to any of your other points, if any of the other testifiers want to speak up.
I will encourage Representative Frederick that you should get out and drive an electric vehicle because they are fun. I highly encourage that. Commissioner Peterson, I don't know if you wanted to address some of those comments.
Yeah, I'd just be brief and see if one of the other testifiers would like to too. But we do burn E15 in the summer now, and we do quite a bit of it. In fact, our E15 sales have been growing steadily in these past years. And you know, COVID, just like with gasoline, took a chunk out of it, but we continue to grow steadily in our E15 usage, and our issues with it to me, I just don't hear that. I do hear, you know, some of that, but, you know, we just see the sales growth being very dramatic in Minnesota right now. I think we have 4,000 nozzles right now, and that's growing every day. As you see, the new Quick Trips all have 88 octane in their pumps. I got B15 today, you know, and so I think there's, the steady growth and people are excited. We see people, you know, because consumers save money. They get the same gas mileage and it's good for the air. But I think perhaps one of the other testifiers would like to add to your comments.
I guess I could add something to that if you want to hear from somebody besides Ag.
Mr. Orton.
I guess part of the carve out of this bill is for E10 because of vehicles that are prior to 2000 because they're not made to run on E15, which I think goes to your question exactly is, you know, is this product for all vehicles? You know, I have a boat that says no more than E10. You know, the carve out says you can have one dispenser that would have E10, which I think from a practical standpoint is unrealistic. You know, we're not going to put in a new tank, piping, dispenser, because we only have so many tanks in the ground. To facilitate that becomes very complicated. I think we're ignoring the fact, just like Representative Frederick said, this isn't going to happen overnight. The vehicles from 2000 back aren't going to leave the road in the next 5 minutes. We need to have a product for them as well. But I think the bigger issue is, you know, we're all talking about, you know, this is a good idea. It's good for ag. They're the ones that stand to benefit by 50% more ethanol use, but it's all in the back of us marketers that are, you're asking to just go upgrade your systems at extremely high cost at the same time when we know that the gallons are going down and it's not going to provide any extra benefit for us. So that I think that's a bigger issue here in my mind.
Thank you, Mr. Orton. Representative Tice, do you have any more follow-up? Oh. Mr. Wordish, sure.
I know I got a couple, and Mr. Thelman is also.
Mr. Wordish wanted to address this real quick, and since I let Mr. Orton, I'm going to let Mr. Wordish, and then I'll
come back.
I'll do it real quick. I'll point out the state of Nebraska just did a study. The government did. They had 25 vehicles, and I think they were new vehicles. I don't remember the exact one, but they had 50 vehicles, and they had 25 running on E30 and 25 running on conventional, you know, E10 probably, whatever they have in the state of Nebraska, and they found no significant difference in the performance of the vehicles that were not, they were not flex fuel vehicles. They found no significant, you know, detrimental performance. So I just like to point that out. That's public. You can certainly research that. So it does address the issue that it'll be harmful for your vehicles. Then also on why do we want to go to the E15 now, Representative Rasmussen? It's been stated a number of times, the clean air. We're dealing with the COVID-19. We're just coming out of that virus, you know, which is a significant health hazard. By just moving from E10 to E15 is going to significantly clean up the air. So that is a reason why to try and move this along as quick as you can. And obviously, the marketers, they have a concern with the cost of installing the pumps or the tanks and pumps, but that can be addressed. So I guess that's my comments.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I just, talking to, like I said, my cousin back home and my son and other folks that I know, I just really don't know that this is going to be worth it. You know, the cars, they keep making gas cars cleaner and cleaner. We see that all the time. But I think when you look at your motor vehicles and your high-performance engines with boats and such, you're just not going to see this being used in that way. And I think that's probably where people would most likely like to save a little bit more dollars so that they can be on the lake all day with their jet ski or their boat and not pay that much more money. I also know that a lot of folks around my area, we have a small cabin on the Richmond chain of lakes. They will buy gas for, oh my gosh, it's over $3 because they don't want to have to deal with it to get off. And they'll pay whatever they have to pay. And that's, for me, a big indication of where I think people are going. They're going to pay what they need to pay to make sure that they can spend family time because they've been holed up for a year. And they do not want to do that anymore. They want to have fun. They want to be out there. I want to get on a motorcycle and ride because it's been really, really sad. And again, I've said this before in other bills, I think we need to look at how do we get our economy going and getting things up and going before we start saying that, oh, hey, you got to put new tanks in. That's huge. People will not do that. So thank you, and I appreciate the time, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to make some comments. I'm not going to really ask any questions because a lot of the things that I want to talk about have already been said before, so let's brush over them. As Representative Rasmussen brought up the difference in between when the mandate needs to be, everybody needs to be on board by 26, and the MPCA report said it would take probably 10 years. The majority of that is not because we can't get tanks and whatnot. There's only so many people that are certified to put in tanks. You can't set tanks year round. A lot of this stuff can only be done after the frost is out of the ground. Mr. Ortman and Carlson, I believe, Mr. Carlson, the two gas station owners have already alluded to the amount of expense this is going to be. And how do you go to the bank and say, hey, I need a loan for $250,000, $300,000 to set a tank, and I'm not going to increase my sales? How do you justify that at the bank? Oh, and by the way, every major, all the big three manufacturers, plus all the European, or not the European, all of the Japanese manufacturers or Asian manufacturers have said they will not be manufacturing a single automobile that runs on gasoline come 2034, not 30 years out in the future, 2034. All of them have said they will not be manufacturing gasoline-powered vehicles or petroleum-powered vehicles, probably a few diesels in there, but no gasoline anymore. They've committed to that, and they're making some pretty huge strides in that. So I'm kind of not understanding. I mean, I get the point that we want to help the farmers, but if you want to buy E15, it's available all over the state. Coming out of COVID, so businesses have been hurting, people have been staying at home, gas sales are down, and that's my outside job. I work in the petroleum industry. You know, I did a layoff last year when we were doing the stay-at-home stuff. Almost 3 months I was out of work, outside employment. So, I mean, the petroleum industry as a whole is not exactly – most people think they're flush with cash and they can just magically come up with everything. It's just, we passed a mandate, so it's all magic. It's all going to happen. Just passing a law does not magically make these things happen. People have costs. You come out of COVID, you're already hurting for business, and now you're going to throw another $200,000 per station, probably on average, let's call it 250, because some of them will be much more expensive. Let's say 250 for a nice round number. So every four tanks or every four stations that has to be done, that's $1 million. MPCA says they believe that 2,400 tanks are going to have to be redone. So that's $600 million. And that's just with that. That's just nuts. How do you justify $600 million for a few year investment? I get the clean air. I get all the rest of that. But we're going to go from zero petroleum or from E10 or California standards and all the rest of these cleaner processes we're using now to an electric, which is about as clean a vehicle as you're going to get, as the chair knows, because he drives one. I just don't see how this works. I don't see how we pass a law and say you will do this and the industry just magically comes up with the dollars. The petroleum industry or the corn growers have said they're going to chip in, but I haven't seen how much. I have not seen any dollars, any percentages or anything like that that says we're committed to half the cost, a quarter of the cost, $1 million, $10 million, $50 million. I haven't seen anything in there. If it's so much per gallon of E15 that they sell or the E15 that's sold, so much per dollar they're going to give back to every station that retrofits that fits this, whatever it is, I haven't seen a formula. So with that, Mr. Chair, that concludes my comments for this evening. I'm sure I'll have a few more on final passage.
Thank you, Representative Barr. Representative Lucero, and if I could
thank,
Go ahead, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Barr, in IT, on the help desk, when I'm supporting people, when they call in with the questions, we have an expression that says we have a bag of magic pixie dust in our desk here that just poof, things get resolved. But you're talking about magic wands. Unfortunately, I don't have a magic wand, but what the government normally does is just bing, we deem it, bing, it shall be done. And that's just how government thinks, Representative Barr. But to Representative, to Mr. Orton, a question for him. Can you explain to me, as I'm reading the bill language here, the upgrades of underground storage tank, and I see fuel dispensing equipment. And I apologize, Mr. Chair, if I missed it. Could you explain to me physically what happens? So if there's an existing tank, what does it look like to upgrade? If there's an existing tank, can that tank somehow be upgraded, or does it physically have to come out of the ground to be replaced by something new, or what does an upgrade actually look like?
Sure, and I'll start by saying it depends. There's a lot of components. What's that?
I was just recognizing you, Mr. Orton.
Okay, I'm sorry. It depends on what your tank system is. There's a multitude of underground storage tanks, from steel to fiberglass to single wall to double wall. And then you also get into your piping. So when we start talking about compatibility for, call it E15, you're looking at a multitude of components, from your tank to your lines to your submersible pumps to your drop tubes and then to your dispensers and any submersibles. What they need to have in order to prove compatibility is a very tall, if not impossible, task in some instances, because you're going back, the tanks are put into, in some instances, late 90s, early 2000s, there's not proper record of the pipe dope, let's say, that was used. Of course, back then, nobody contemplated E10, E15, so they didn't necessarily test it before that went in, because they didn't know it was a future product. So the problem that we run into as an industry is proving compatibility with E15. So then the MPCA comes along and says, well, you can't prove compatibility, so if you want to continue selling, you must upgrade to something that satisfies that. So if you're in a position where you can't prove it on anything, you may be replacing all those parts. And I can tell you from firsthand experience, having done, you know, a new raise and rebuild with a whole new underground storage tank system, if you're in that boat, that could be $500,000 all day long for not even a very robust system. We've done a couple of different repipes in the last 2-3 years where we, you know, replace the dispensers, put in new piping and new submersibles. That might be a $150,000, $300,000 fix. The part that oftentimes is lost is it's not just your UST system, it's the concrete, it's the electrical conduit, it's everything that goes along with it. I think it would shock people. I mean, I could literally send you invoices from projects we've done in the last 2-3 years that aren't even full replacements, and I'm talking hundreds of thousands of dollars.
All right.
But I don't know if that answered your question.
Representative Lucero, we only have a couple minutes left, and I want to get one other bill through that we're going to lay over.
Oh, no more questions, Mr. Chair. Just one quick comment.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then it's just a rhetorical question for the committee, for the bill author. Why stop? So as we just heard from Mr. Orton, that when the E10 was put in, E15 wasn't conceived as a future mandate. But why stop at E15? Why not go to E25? Why not E50? Why not E75? I believe that it was, our new climate czar, John Kerry, didn't he recently say that the world is ending in 9 years anyway, global climate change, or AOC said it was 11 years 2 years ago. So the world's coming to an end in 9 years anyway. So we better expedite this. So why, rhetorically, are we doing E15? Because if they put the E15 compatible equipment in, the government's going to come along and they're going to deem with their magic wand, you shall comply with E25 in a few years from now, because the world's ending. So why not just raise it now? My thought. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. Representative Frederick, do you have any brief closing comments before we lay over? We will, of course, have a chance to revisit this bill next week.
I appreciate the committee. I appreciate the discussion tonight, and I look forward to having further discussion next week.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. And with that, I will lay the bill over until next week. We will now move on to House File 1165. As with House File 1433. We're going to hear the bill, take testimony, and then lay it over in recognition of the fact that an amendment is coming, and then we will have testimony of the amendment next week. We won't have time tonight, I think, for member discussion on this bill, so we'll just do the testimony. Representative Wasilick, I will move House File 1165 be laid over for further consideration, and Representative Wasilick, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Food and beverage packaging that is falsely labeled as biodegradable or compostable is contaminating our organics waste stream, in large part because the labeling is unclear or confusing for people who buy or use these products. House File 1165 modifies requirements for labeling items as biodegradable or compostable. It requires that covered items labeled as compostable meet certain requirements and requires compostable products be certified by a third-party organization for them to be sold or distributed in Minnesota. This change is an important step in clarifying for the public which items are truly compostable, as well as reducing contamination at composting sites, allowing them to produce more higher quality compost. These changes can also help reduce microplastics that end up in our environment. This legislation is supported by a wide range of stakeholders, including the three compostable product manufacturing companies in the state, composting facilities, the Solid Waste Administrators Association, the Association of Recycling Managers, cities and counties who have organics composting programs, and more. That's a brief walkthrough of what the bill does, and I know that there are testifiers here to talk more about this.
All right, the first testifier I have is Ginny Black from the Minnesota Composting Council. Ms. Black.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and committee members, and thank you for hearing our bill and Representative Wasilick for carrying it for us. We really appreciate it. I am the chair of the Minnesota Compost Council, which is a small nonprofit organization that was established in 2013. We are a chapter of the United States Composting Council, and our mission is to develop the development, expansion, and promotion of the composting industry based on sound science, principles of sustainability, and not economic viability. And this bill encompasses all three of those goals. We initiated this bill 3 or 4 years ago. It's hard to remember when we actually started down this road because it's been a while. And we've been working closely with the Pollution Control Agency, and this particular bill mirrors closely, although there are some language changes, the bill that the Pollution Control Agency has. To start us off with just kind of a primer on the economics of a compost facility, these facilities have two revenue sources. They get tip fee from the material coming into the facility, and then the sale of the finished compost at the end. So that's their two revenue sources. And this particular bill is targeting the material, the compost at the end. The hardest contaminant to remove from compost is plastics. It's very light, it goes through the screens, it flies all over and recontaminates the finished product even after you've screened it. So it's a difficult material. And so the goal really here was over the last, since 1995, I've been working with this particular type of material and the development of it. The goal is to reduce the plastic by having the material be truly compostable. There are a lot of products out there that claim compostability, but really they don't meet what is considered to be the gold standard of compostable plastics, which is D6868 and D6400, the standards that are in this bill. As we discussed this, we realized that this is really kind of a consumer, this bill, that it's really a truth in advertising. There's a greenwashing going on, and consumers really don't know if a product is truly compostable or not. And there's some folks here who will talk about that and the education that they have to do with their curbside programs and the difficulties that they face with this. So the bill would eliminate misleading compostability claims. It would reduce consumer confusion and reduce, ultimately, not eliminate, but reduce the contamination of source separated organic compostable materials collected at the curb and from businesses that are delivered to compost facilities. There's a letter that you received today that says that there is an adequate existing regulatory framework. I would submit that there isn't, simply because we still have a lot of issues here that are going on. But they're not required. These are guidelines, by and large. They're even called guidelines when you see them. And the products are not, manufacturers of these products are not required to meet the ASTM D6400 and 6868 standard. That is the certification process. It is expensive, and a lot of companies don't want to go through that process, and they will make the claim without doing that, and their products may or may not be truly compostable. An example of this would be there are some products on the market that take small pieces of regular plastic, the kind you'd get in your plastic grocery bag, for example, and it will knit these small pieces of plastic together with compostable plastics. So when that product ends up at a compost facility, the compostable plastic does decompose, but the other plastic remains, and it leaves plastic in the finished product, it's microplastics in the environment. Consumers have no idea that this is happening because there's a claim that it's compostable. Well, you know, is that really compostable, or is it only sort of compostable? You know, so you run into these kinds of issues when consumers are not required to meet the ASTM D6400 and 6868 standards, and it's very, very confusing for the consumer themselves. And with that, there's lots of other folks who want to talk, and I'll just stand for questions if there are any.
Great. Well, we have six more testifiers and 12 more minutes, so I think it's going to work out pretty perfectly. Shannon Pink from NatureWorks is the next testifier. Ms. Pink.
Yeah. Hi. Can everyone hear me?
We can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Shannon Pince, and I'm representing NatureWorks. NatureWorks is a global supplier of compostable biomaterials, and we are locally based here in Minnetonka, Minnesota. NatureWorks supports House File 1165 for a variety of reasons, including the fact that it includes ASTM 6400-6868 standard compostability, which is accepted by Minnesota composters as well as composters in other states and across North America. This standard is not intended to deal with landfill or marine or home or other environments, so those standards are not relevant to Minnesota nor this bill. As I've stated, the standards used in the U.S. for compostability are D6400, D6868, which you'll hear many times, while in Europe it is EN13432. Both of those use pass-fail criteria and indicate certain tests that need to be met. Certification entities such as BPI, the Biodegradable Products Institute, certify products and materials against these standards and the criteria within them. Other certifiers such as TÜV Austria and DinCERCO certify against the European standards. Composters in Minnesota recognize the ASTM standards and BPI as a certifying entity and do not want to add confusion by including other standards not recognized nor broadly used in this market. So this can impact consumers as well as composters at their facilities. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Benson. Sorry for mispronouncing your name. We'll move to public testimony. We have 10 minutes, 5 testifiers, so each testifier gets 2 minutes, which is good, because that's the standard practice in this committee anyway. First testifier is Tony Quilis from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce.
Evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tony Quilis. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Couple of concerns, Mr. Chairman. With House File 1165, you'll notice on the definitions of biodegradable and compostable, it was previously manufacturer, distributor, or wholesaler. That change now to person puts the onus on restaurants, retailers, and the corner grocery store, Mr. Chairman, number one. Number two, on 1.16 and 1.17, anytime there's a change in any of those terms or ASTM standards, they have to be approved by the legislature. So, for example, if one of them changed in June, we'd have to wait for the legislature to come back in January, and it provides uncertainty for the business community. Mr. Chairman, the certification of compostable products has been mentioned, and we know that the Biodegradable Products Institute is the gold standard, but I'd like to keep working with Representative Wasilewicz because there's three requirements there, and I'm not sure that all of those folks have the certification process and the capability to do that, Mr. Chairman. Finally, two last points, Mr. Chairman, on the enforcement and $100 per package at a max of $5,000, possibly a written notice before those fines are implemented. Mr. Chairman, there are three or four other states, California, Washington, and Maryland, that have also got laws somewhere along in here. I just want to make sure that all the definitions and ASTM standards are available to the business community for these products. And one final example, there's been a lot of work in this area, specifically in biopolymers. I've been able to get that out this late in the day, at the University of Minnesota. So it's technology is moving and changing. We just want to make sure that that's included in here, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. The next testifier is Chuck Joswiak.
Hi, my name is Chuck Joswiak. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm representing Specialized Environmental Technologies. We're one of the largest privately owned composters here in Minnesota. We process both food and yard waste at several MPCA permitted locations in the metro area. Greenwashing terms on products like biodegradable, environmentally friendly, natural, or eco-friendly, degradable, they kind of all tend to confuse customers and consumers. And they may sometimes infer that they break down in a composting system, becoming safe. But this is not necessarily the case. Only those products that meet ASTM pass-fail decomposition standards within a certain time frame in a specific environment like composting are actually known to break down properly. Other standards and biodegradable claims are not always equal and cause more harm or confusion than good. Contamination in many forms is by far the biggest issue that us composters face each day. I can guarantee that without efforts to change the current language and make these products easily identifiable, we will soon be forced to refuse compostable products due to the significant contamination that often accompanies these products. Transitioning to food-only programs has been a national trend that will have significant impacts on Minnesota companies based here and those compostable products. It's also going to increase the volumes that go to landfills. Trash and look-alike products entering our sites add significant cost to our operations, but also increase the chance of introducing specific contaminants like PFAS and microplastics. It's vital that these contaminants are reduced prior to the composting process, and this really just starts with eliminating products that are packaged with misleading terms. These products hamper our operation, and they jeopardize the safety of our employees. They obstruct air and water movement through our processing and are virtually impossible to screen out in the end to create a desirable product. It's essential to properly identify these items as compostable or compostable because the term is clear and concise in its end system of disposal and use. I really urge you all to support this legislation and make sure that consumers and those composters trying to process these products are purchasing and receiving products that truly are beneficial to the environment. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you. The next testifier is Emily Barker. Ms. Barker.
Good evening, Chairman Stevenson and committee. Thank you very much for your time. My name is Emily Barker. I represent the Association for Recycling Managers. We are a nonprofit group here in Minnesota made up of cities, counties, and state employees who work on recycling education. We are here today to support House File 1165. Many of our cities already have organics programs in place or will in the very near future. And reducing confusion, as has already been mentioned by several folks, is really key to keeping these programs successful. Unfortunately, there are a lot of products on the market that make claims about the sustainability. And unfortunately, it's not really clear to residents. We tell folks to look for things like the BPI logo to really ensure they're getting the products we want. In my household, I have these two packages, which are both labeled with the words compostable, but after further research, I've been unable to verify that it's a legitimate claim because none of the salespeople can clarify what standards they were tested to and that there's no BPI certification. So unfortunately, we have to tell our residents to put products like that in the garbage.
Having clear labeling is also important because a few years ago, this very same legislature passed a requirement that Twin Cities Metro counties meet a 75% recycling goal. I'm going to tell you now that without successful organics programs, that goal is not going to be reachable. Organics must be part of the equation. And as Chuck mentioned, having properly labeled materials helps ensure we maximize the amount of organics or materials that end up in organics instead of the trash. Finally, we want to see a clean quality compost product created that our cities, counties, and the state can purchase for road and construction projects. And the best way to get that is to ensure that we have clean quality material going into our composting facilities. Having this labeling is not going to solve all of the problems. I certainly know that as a recycling educator. I've got work to do for a while, but it certainly will help. And this is one clear way and first step to helping with this. Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. The next testifier is Vineet Dalla.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for allowing me to testify today. My name is Vineet Dalal, and I'm Vice President for Northern Technologies International Corporation. We are a Minnesota-based company based in Circle Pines, and we manufacture compostable biopolymers that we sell through our global operations worldwide. As most of the speakers ahead of me have talked about the increasing cost of contamination that composters in Minnesota face, especially in their input feed stream, it is absolutely important that we need a bill that prevents misleading claims by manufacturers about what is truly biodegradable in a composting facility. We believe this bill expands the existing Minnesota compostable bag labeling requirements to all single-use food service packaging by linking the term compostable to clearly defined ASTM D6400 and D6868 pass-fail standard specifications for compostability. And more importantly, it would prevent manufacturers from using greenwashing terms such as biodegradable or oxodegradable to confuse consumers into thinking plastic items could go into compost bins, thereby causing contamination for composting facilities. In summary, this bill is good for consumers, the environment, and for Minnesota-based businesses. And Northern Technologies strongly supports this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And then the last public testifier is Vicki O'Rourke. Ms. O'Rourke.
Thank you, Chair. Good evening, Chair and members of the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. My name is Vicki O'Rourke. I am corporate counsel for WinCup. WinCup is a manufacturer of disposable food service products, including compostable and marine biodegradable products. Let me be clear. Our compostable products did pass ASTM 6400. We are BPI certified. We're not opposed to that piece of this bill, but the reason we oppose House File 1165 is because of the unintended consequences and the unanswered questions with this bill. Are you going to be allowed to make a home compostable claim after this bill is passed? Why are you disallowing all biodegradable claims? With respect to that in particular, have you considered the impact that that's going to have on Minnesota's farmers who grow canola, rapeseed, and soy crops? Just to link this all together, biopolymer sustainable products, which are coming brand new to the market, and everyone needs education on them, are made, the primary feedstock in those products are canola oil and soy. There's a huge growth opportunity here for the farmers of Minnesota, which, you know, this is a leading crop of Minnesota, to grow their business. This is cutting edge research that is being done by the University of Minnesota. They are being sponsored by the National Science Foundation. It's actually, per the website, the mission of the NSF Center for Sustainable Polymers is to transform how plastics are made, unmade, and remade. Because House File 1165 limits the truthful claims that manufacturers will be allowed to make about their products, such as marine biodegradable, it's going to stifle innovation in biopolymers and new product development, and it may foreclose a significant growth opportunity for Minnesota's agricultural sector. So we urge the committee to refrain from just rushing this bill through and to give further consideration to some of these important questions. Thank you very much, Chair and committee.
Thank you very much. And we are certainly not going to rush the bill. We're laying it over, which is what we will do now. Representative Wasilek, I'll give you the opportunity if you had anything you wanted to say in response to the testimony before we close up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I just want to sort of reiterate what you said. This isn't a rush. This has been worked on for the last several years, and it's been brought up in the legislature before. So there's been lots of opportunities to sort of have these conversations. I would also say that there's nothing that says that we can't make changes as things change. We do that a lot at the legislature. As things change, as technologies change, we come back and make changes. Our goal here is to make it so that consumers know what they're buying. They know what sort of products they can and cannot that are compostable and are not. And as somebody who is a composter, I have a small compost bin here. I want to know that. I don't want to put things in those compost bins that end up going to my county's composting facility that actually aren't compostable. I don't want to have a role in contaminating that waste stream. So I think this is a really good, as others have said, a consumer bill, so folks can be informed, but also helping on the end where the compost is coming out so that folks who are using that compost are getting a high quality product. So look forward to continued discussion when the bill comes back.
Well, thank you, Representative Wazlik, for bringing the bill on the good discussion tonight. Apologies we ran short on time, but that's where we're at. So we will be back next week to take up these bills and others. Until then, we are adjourned.